I happened this last week to have been in California, making a little tour of television and radio stations, not to sit back and talk with the managers about the nature or future of what we call the media, because nobody has time to sit back and meditate. You get to a television station at 7 a.m, and the first big show is already starting up, and so it is in every station in the country. Because although NBC has a network show covering all its stations across the country, and it starts at 7 a.m. and ends at 9, the independent stations have one or two or three of their own as well. The NBC program, which comes from New York, is called Today, and it has to be a masterpiece of organization. It has an anchor woman, so-called, Barbara Walters, easily the most recognizable woman in the United States, and an anchor man for news bulletins and a resident critic. They begin with the latest bulletins in, and they cut away to any film that's come in or is coming in over the satellite if the news is from overseas. The other morning, wiping the sleepy granules from my eyelids, I heard about President Ford and then saw him with Brezhnev, heard about the release of the last hostages held by the Arab hijackers and saw them, saw Nelson Rockefeller explaining to the press the cruel, bad, new news about his wife. And then we went to various parts of the United States to hear and see what the heavy snows were doing to Vermont, what the United States Border Patrol was doing down on the banks of the Rio Grande, to the so-called wetbacks, the Mexicans illegally wading through the river to get jobs in the United States. That was about the hot point of the news for the first 15 minutes of the show. So then we went to an interview between a distinguished doctor who's just written a book about depression and Barbara Walters on who gets depressed, at what ages, and why, what has been done about it historically, and what drugs and other forms of treatment can do about it today. By the time that was over, there was a bulletin in about a tentative agreement between the coal industry and the miners, and we went over to hear what both sides had to say about that. Almost simultaneously, the word came in that a strike which had been going on for a week of a transcontinental bus line had been settled, and we saw some of the troubles the company was having getting the word to its employees who were off napping or watching a football game or gone fishing or whatever. Now it was time for the newsman to appear again before two great maps and weather satellite photos and tell us the outlook for the weather from Alaska to Florida. Time now for the critic to take over. Federico Fellini, the Italian film director, has been in New York, and the critic took him to lunch, or vice versa, at an Italian restaurant down in the Italian Quarter, and they filmed a good 10-15 minute interview with him, which was given an added zest by the random comments of the Americans, especially the Italian-speaking ones, who were lunching nearby. Then it was time for what they call an update of the news for the scores of stations that come in on the 8 to 9 a.m. segment. You understand that this whole two-hour program is taped in New York beginning at 7, and then is played an hour later for the Midwest, 2 hours later still for the Mountain States, 3 hours later for the Pacific Coast, so that everybody, wherever he lives, is getting it at his 7 or 8 a.m. Well, after the recent hassle in the United Nations about allowing the chief of the Palestine Liberation Organization to speak before the General Assembly, they managed to get Mr. Arafat's chief observer to go along to the studio, and under some sharp questioning by Miss Walters and the newsman, he gave the case for an independent Palestine run by Mr. Arafat and his lieutenants. More news, a recap of the weather, and two South Africans were in town being questioned about the rights and wrongs of apartheid, and a more informative section about how it works. After that, the critic had just seen a new movie and he came on and slammed it in a genial fashion. And then a final news recap, another author, a whip out to Kansas to hear about the prospects for the wheat crop, what it might do to the price of bread and to Russian-American relations, and that was just about it. I have no notion what these 2 hours cost. It must be a fortune, with cameramen and correspondents on tap all over the United States and Europe and Vladivostok and Syria and Israel, you name it. But the picture, the national picture of television news coverage, spreads alarmingly if you then move off to the local stations affiliated with the other 3 networks, 2 commercial, the third, the non-commercial public broadcasting system. And then you go on again to the independent local TV and radio stations, of which there are usually about, half a dozen in each big city. Because they too are competing with today. They have their own Barbara Walters, and from 8 a.m. certainly on through till twilight, there are literally hundreds of talk shows punctuated by news bulletins and cutaways for on-the-spot filmed news coverage. Now, if you're old or sick or simply a listless type living off welfare, it would be possible for you to see and hear, wherever you were, about 20 news talk shows a day. Quite apart from the hourly news bulletins lasting anywhere from 5 to 15 minutes that are put on by most radio stations. Understand this, including the 2-hour Today show, does not happen once a week. It happens 5 or 6 days a week. On Sunday, there is a marvelous surcease of news, allowing you the morning to plow through with a couple of hundred pages of your Sunday newspaper, with a good chance of coming through by noon, when they think it's time you caught up with the news again, of course. Every night at 6:30 or 7, the entire 900-odd television stations across the country go over to a half hour of the day's news from America, Europe, Asia, the Middle East. The question would occur to a Martian, or even to a European visitor, what to do with this unceasing flow of news from 7 to midnight. To most people these days, most of it must seem like a merciless catalogue of disaster. And it's made all the more impressive, more difficult to expunge from the mind, by the prime fact about television, which is that you see the riot, the strike, the hijacker with a gun, the people wilting from starvation in Africa. It's a very rare day, last Monday was one of them, when the program opens with 4 items of good news. 2 national strikes settled, the hijacker's hostages released, and President Ford's surprisingly successful and apparently almost impromptu agreement with Mr. Brezhnev about arms limitation. It is convenient and comfortable for nations that have no such waterfalls of news crashing about their eyes and ears all day to say that such overwhelming coverage is not necessary and only makes people jumpy and morbid. They have a point. But ignorant bliss doesn't pay off historically. I think, for instance, of this time last year, around Christmas time anyway, I was in the south of France, and for 10 days and nights I was reduced to the news available on French television. I say reduced advisedly, for you have to be marooned with a government-controlled television system to appreciate that ignorance breeds torpor. Every evening we had a well-modulated news program of no more than 10 minutes, delivered in elegant French, which contained glimpses of a few catastrophes happening abroad, and always a local fire. The French love fires. It appeared that nothing at all was happening in France except a heavy snowfall in the Alps and that fire. There was nothing, no report, however snippety, from London or Washington. They would have had a bit about Patricia Hearst if her kidnapping had happened then. Nothing from the United Nations, from Africa, Asia. It was extremely soothing and, on second thought, extremely alarming. For life and political struggle surely go on in France. But outside the couple of good Parisian newspapers, there was no hint of it. It threw me back to the trembly days of 1937 and 8, when Hitler was rampaging away. And I recall how the American papers were full of dispatches about the impregnability of the Maginot Line, but also articles reporting how some upstart colonel or other, a fellow named, as I remember, de Gaulle, saying it wasn't impregnable at all, because armored warfare would either crash through it or go round it, which it did, and how the French politicians in authority pooh-poohed the naive dispatches of American reporters about how the communists and their defeatist propaganda had corroded the general morale. And I wonder now how many Frenchmen were reading or hearing on the radio the same ominous news, because there is abundant evidence to show that their ignorance or their complacency, or both, had conditioned them for defeat long before June 1940. So though to be over-informed may stimulate panic, it does not encourage the delusion that the country is taking a snooze, or that bad news comes from abroad, or worst of all, that the government of your country is out of reach of its ordinary citizen. I've been here on the West Coast for nearly 2 weeks, and in the face of the European myth that California is some sort of sunstruck haven, nowhere in America, nowhere that I know outside America, can you feel so in the thick of the world's troubles and controversies. I was not moving among a particularly enlightened or intellectual minority, but whenever I went out for a meal, or even teed off on a pastoral landscape with no other noise than the birds and the click of the club face, I was never sure what would come up for argument with the next course or the next iron shot. Once we had to let a threesome through because one of our group was busy defending something he'd read in The Economist against a discussion he'd seen on television. And that naturally had to do with how much we are beholden to the Arabs, not for oil, but for capital investment. And meanwhile, the airwaves and the newspapers thunder with the din of arguments about chlorinated water, the anti-Semitic remarks of the Chief of Staff, the future of British democracy, of Ulster, the American policy in Cuba, the intentions of Zhou Enlai, how to boost mortgages for private housing, the local revival of jazz, how to make mass transportation take the strain off the motor car, the discovery by American physicists of two elementary particles, the plight of the French automobile industry, and so on and so on. Of only one thing did I feel sure. If American democracy goes under, it will end not with a whimper, but a bang.